Hey, it's me, Paige DeSorbo, and I'm so excited to share my new shoe collection at DSW, filled with my favorite styles and trends for spring. Because if you know me, you know I'm kind of obsessed with shoes. And by kind of obsessed, I mean head over heels. You're going to love these shoes. So snag super cute styles like cute flats, fun heels, and cool sneakers from the Paige DeSorbo collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So I read in USA Today that the majority of people stop GLP-1 weight loss injection shots in a year. Now, what's concerning is if you get off GLP-1s, there's a real chance you can gain all the weight back. The solution? Alma said, a natural superfood protein shake. University studies show it optimizes your metabolism so you can lose weight easily, and Alma said it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Use Alma said with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almased.com. That's almased.com.
Hello. Richard Marcus, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you today?
Okay. Who am I speaking with?
My name is Slim. Laszlo's sitting across from me, and our producer Spencer's in the other room.
All right. Slim, Laszlo, and Spencer. Yeah, everything's cool. So I'm looking forward to this little, what's it called? The sport, the drive around? What's it called, the show?
The church. You almost had it. The Church of Laszlo.
No, I know that. The Church of Laszlo. Yeah, I remember that name, but I remember something about it. What do you call the? I forgot. Like a drive around.
Oh, maybe our producer when he sends out that email, he says it's afternoon drive. Yeah.
Yes, there you go.
That's it.
Yeah. So I'm ready to go.
Awesome. We're excited to talk to you because he is the one who sent us your information originally, and said I know you guys are going to be interested in talking to this guy because it's everything that you love. It's scams. Yeah. It's casinos. It's casino scams. It's the redemption arc. The whole thing, and. One of the things that I think the first thing that he sent us was a video where you kind of ran through the different scams, and I'm fascinated. But can we just real quickly get kind of a background on who you are and how you ended up? I know you kind of ended up getting recruited, and I think that part of the story is fascinating, how you ended up becoming a casino scammer.
Yes, I will give that. I'll tell you the whole quick story. Degenerate gambler since I'm 8 years old, right? You know, when I was 8 years old, I was already like gambling with, the thing was baseball cards. Kids, I'm almost 100 years old now. So it's back then when I was a kid, what we did is we collected baseball cards. And that was your identity. How many cards you had,
sure.
That was your identity, you know, like money, currency. And so I.
Where
I,
is this? What city?
This was happening in New York.
Okay.
City.
All right.
And then, so the kids.
The Yankees fans, Met fan, which one?
Yeah, diehard Yankee fans.
Okay. All
still
right.
Am. Yeah, still am. So we would flip the cards. By flipping the cards, most people think of flipping baseball cards like against the wall. Whoever got closest to the wall would keep the cards in the pot. But actually, there was another way of flipping cards called colors, where each team logo had a color. And there were usually two or four teams that had the same color logo. So when you held the cards in your hand, like dealing cards, like playing cards in a poker game, and you would turn them over, and if your logo, if the card you just turned over matched the last card in the pot, the logo of that, and they were the same color logo, you won the pot.
Okay. And, all right.
And that's, yeah, and it was gambling, basically. And so we would do that, and then I realized, your baseball card collection was, like I said, your whole identity. And I realized one day, I was losing all my cards and, at an abnormal rate. And I finally figured out that there were a bunch of kids, they were cheating me. And the way they were cheating me is they were dealing seconds, like a crooked poker dealer, dealing seconds of baseball cards, because when they saw the card in the pot, the top card on the pot, which is exposed, they could see, let's say, the logo is yellow, and then they read the top card on their deck, on the back of their, on the top of the deck, and they would know by memorizing, the color of each team's logo, whether or not that card would match the yellow logo in the pot.
Got it.
If they did, they just leave it there. If they didn't, they would just pull that card back and deal the second card, not knowing what the logo of the second card was, but at least they'd have a chance that it would, would be the right color. And over the long run, that's way enough of an edge to beat the game. So I realized I was losing my baseball cards to cheaters. And then I came up with, kiddie scams to cheat them. Like, just to give you a real quick example of that, a couple of years later, my friend's brother was old enough to drive. And, we were all degenerates, so we would, hang around on the corner of a street. And I was actually living outside of Manhattan in a suburb. And we would stand on a street, and we would bet on the type of car that would come around the corner. And it was a middle-class neighborhood, so, each person involved in this would get a chance to pick the car and determine the odds. So let's say if it was a Ford, the odds would be maybe 3-1. And anyone who wanted to bet would put his money in and be paid 3-1. If it was a Mercedes, the odds would be 20-1 or 30-1.
Okay. Did you have these listed, the odds? Did you have everybody have them in their pocket?
Like
a Maserati's 100-1? Did you have a line on them?
Well, no, we weren't that coordinated.
Okay.
We just came up with it. And the chances of a Maserati would have to be 5,000-1.
Well, I don't know. I figured you're in Manhattan. Somebody's got one. I don't know.
No, yeah, but in Manhattan, yeah, but like, I, yeah, we were in a middle-class neighborhood. So,
okay.
So one of my friends, right, a guy by the name of Balls, who later became my partner, one of my partners in the casino cheating business.
So his birth name is Balls?
I guess that's a nickname. Well,
I don't know if it says it on his birth certificate. but that's what we called him, right?
Yeah, you called him Balls. Did they have a nickname for you? I'm just curious, because in my head I'm picturing this. I don't know what year it is, but I just have you in a leather jacket looking like C from A Bronx Tale saying, hey, I think a Mercedes is going to come next. Yeah. And Balls is fuck you, 100-1. Yeah. Like, I like the idea of it.
Great movie. But my father wasn't a bus driver, though. Chaz Palmieri. I remember that movie. Great movie. But anyway, I was pretty slick, and I did wear a lot of leather jackets, but I didn't have a nickname. But anyway, so Balls, he was a little skinny, thin guy, and we called him Balls because he's the kind of guy that he would just throw a couple of grand in a poker hand, not give a shit.
Right.
I mean, he was just total Balls, so we just called him that. So his brother was 17, and we were at the time, 10 or 11. His parents had a Mercedes, and the parents, they had two cars. So one night they went out and they left the Mercedes in the garage, and we arranged with Balls, or Balls arranged with his brother. There were no cell phones at the time. We're talking in the late 60s.
Sure. Right? Okay.
And there were no cell phones, so we had walkie-talkies. So we arranged, like I said before, each kid would pick the car that would come around the block. So I said, All right, I say the next car is going to be a Mercedes, and the odds are 50-1. Okay, so you know, and we all have, you know, for a bunch of little brats, we all have cash, right? Mm-hmm. So the kids are putting in their money, right? And I got that backwards. We also played, like, the people betting the money can pick the car.
Oh, okay.
Like,
okay.
I say,
yep. Okay.
Right. I say it's going to be a Mercedes, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I said, I say the car is going to be a Mercedes, right? And they looked at me like, what are you, nuts? And I said, how much odds you want on that? So we'll pay you 20-1 on that. I said, no, I want 50-1 on that. And they looked around and they said, well, there was no shot of that happening, right? Because there hadn't been a Mercedes come around that corner in a couple of years, right?
Right.
So there was no shot of that happening. So they said, all right, we'll pay you the 50-1, right? So me, Balls, and one other guy that was in on it with us, we put in our money. We put in $20 each. Right, and then like Balls like snuck around the bush, and he got his walkie-talkie out, and he radioed his brother, and he said, "All right, come on." And we did this at a time it was very late at night, so we did this where there was not much traffic, right?
Right.
So you know, and we didn't want to, you know, get this fucked up where it wouldn't be
right where somebody else beat you, somebody other car beat you to the spot.
Yeah, right, right. So, so sure enough, right? We got he was parked. The guy's brother was parked, you know, just you know, like a quarter mile away, just out of sight. So the chance of another car interfering were like zero, but we couldn't see because it was dark outside, right? So anyway, so we put our money up, we put our $20 in there, and Walls' brother comes with the Mercedes, and these kids were crying for like 2 weeks after that.
Right? Sure, but thus is born a degenerate gambler, as you put it, and also someone who knows. It's best to not let it all rest on luck. Let's find a way to have the advantage.
Well, of course, I live by that. that's credence, man. That
well, for some people, you know, they go to the casino, and it's like, I think if they win something big early on, that can really trigger that mechanism in their brain that says, this is good. Well, let's keep coming back. I know I can win this money back.
That's exactly what happened to me. I'll get to that in a second. Okay. But anyway, So I started doing childhood scams and stuff like this. And then, you know, when I got to high school, you know, I was never going to classes. We were running craps games in the cafeteria. When I was 13 years old, I mean, I knew the ins and outs of craps, baccarat, you know, every casino game. And at the time, there was only casinos in Las Vegas. You know, I'd never been to a casino, but, you know, I knew everything about gambling. So.
Well, just out of curiosity, and it has nothing to do with your story, but what year did they go to Jersey? It feels like there'll be some in Jersey at some point.
What year did they open up?
Yeah.
Again, this is 78.
Okay, so you're a little bit before. Okay, got it.
Yeah, so yeah, before that. So you know, I'm getting thrown out of high school or suspended, and never actually got expelled. I got suspended a couple of times for, you know, running craft games in the cafeteria. They didn't like that much. So anyway, now so finally, you know, now I'm 17, and I start going to the horse race, the trotters and the pacer track, right?
Yeah.
Or the Yonkers in Roosevelt, New York, and I start going there, and I get lucky, and I went, and I wasn't even old enough to legally.
I was just gonna ask.
Yeah,
wasn't even old enough to legally gamble, so I went with $300 my first night. I lost. Then I went back a couple other nights, and, you know, within a couple of weeks, and I lost, $200-$300 each time. And then, like, the fifth time, and I was a freak. When I went to the track, like, I didn't know anything about, you know, who to bet on. I didn't even know how to read a program. I would just go up to the window, and I would just start yelling, okay, I want $3 box triples. And I would just yell. I would just yell three numbers, 832, 621, 133. I had no idea what I was doing. I just needed the action, right?
Right.
So one day, one night, like I said, it's like the fifth time I was there. I'm doing just that. And when the horses are going around the track, right, everybody's like yelling and screaming. And I'm just sitting there. I don't even know who I bet. I'm just sitting there waiting for the race to end.
Yeah, you don't know who to root for because you just shouted a bunch of numbers earlier. You're like, I don't know who the hell.
Right, I got a bunch of, you know, the tickets were $18 each, you know, so I have 20 tickets each race, and I wait for the finish, And now I'm just going through the tickets to see if I had any winners. And that's what I did the first four times and lost. And then that fifth time on the race, right? Just like always, I'm going through the tickets, right? And the first thing I noticed is the horse that won the race was 99-1 on the tote board,
oof,
right? Which means the odds were 99-1 or higher. And the horse that came in second was 20-1, and the horse that came the third was 8-1. And the two favorites in the race, if you know anything about horse racing, sure, when I say, didn't even come in the money.
Okay.
You know, which means they didn't come first, second, or third. So I knew it was going to be a giant payoff, right? So, but of course, I didn't think there was any chance I had it.
Because you bet this like trifecta or whatever it's called. Right, these three horses had to come in this
trifecta
exact order.
Trifecta box. So it can come in any way as long as you get all three of them.
Okay.
You got it. Trifecta box.
Well, I happen to be a degenerate gambler myself from a...
I was kind of getting that impression.
you felt it a little bit? You know, yeah, kind of like, interesting. Like, I grew up...
If you and I met back in the day, even in Kansas City, is that where you're from?
Yeah.
Well, I'm from Detroit originally, and, you know, similar story. I grew up probably about 2 miles away from the horse track in Detroit, Ladbrook DRC, and we used to skip school and go there and put money on the horses. And I remember, you know, my first lesson in real degenerate gambling, there was two of them at that horse track is where, we would gamble a little bit. You know, on sports and whatnot, you know, but going there's two things. You could get into the track, you could buy the ticket, but you couldn't cash that fucker. And I remember when we won the first time, I won like $550 or something, which was, you know, amazing,
sure,
at 15, 16 years old. But we couldn't go up and cash it because you had to show your ID to cash it. So we had to call a buddy of mine's older brother, and he came and cashed it and took 250 of it. And I remember right then, like, all right, I like this, but I got to figure something fucking out here. You know what I mean? I got to get a fake ID or something.
Wait a minute. Either this is like an amazing coincidence, and you're somehow in my mind, or you read some of my story already about my experience at the track.
I've never read your story at the track.
Wow, this is amazing.
To be honest, I watched like 10 minutes of your video, and I was like, all right, I can talk gambling. I'm not worried about it.
Okay, well, you're this is amazing because you're gonna hold this. I'm counting I'm going through the tickets at the finish line. Remember, I'm 17 years old. You had to be 21, not 18, 21
okay,
to gamble in New York State, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going through the tickets, and I know it's a huge triple. And like halfway through the tickets, I got the numbers. And the triple paid $8,000. Okay, I got the numbers.
Nice.
$8,000, right? I'm going through the tickets. Again, I'm not done yet. Boom, I got it a second time.
Ooh.
Oh, damn.
I'm going through it, boom, three times, $24,000.
Wow.
Wow. Well, you can't cash it.
Yeah, they might check your ID for this.
There you go. Three times, three times, $8,000, $24,000. And now, I can't describe to you the shot of adrenaline that was.
Right.
When it hit me, that holy, I'm talking 17 years old, 24 grand. Right.
Right.
I mean, my mom would be pissed if I went gambling underage, if I went to the track underage. But if I called her and said, listen, I did this, I know you're going to be upset, but I need you to come cash this ticket because it's worth 24 grand. I think she'd forgive me.
They do it, but it was like, now I'm gambling. Plus, I'm skipping school. Like, it was like, man, I need somebody's older brother to come here.
Well, you know, man, I had that same thought in my mind, but my parents already knew. I mean, I'm getting thrown out of school every 2 weeks. They already knew it was a zero. So listen to this. So the four times that I was there before that, I was talking to a security guard. I just was talking to this guy, to a security guard, and it's not like we were friends, but, you know, the second, third, and fourth times, and the fifth time I came in there, you know, we said hello, and we talked a little bit, and then, anyway, so Now I got the 24,000. I got the three tickets worth 24,000. And of course, I'm saying to myself, all right, Richard, how are you going to cash it out? Because I already knew about the I knew about the 300-to-1 thing. You know, regardless of if you cash any of those tickets out and the ratio of your win is 300-to-1 or more, and that law still exists today in most states, probably all of them, you have to fill out forms and everything. So that was only one of the problems. But the big problem was being illegal, being underage. That was right. The big problem. So I didn't know what to do. And, you know, all these thoughts were going through my brain, like, you know, what you're talking about, the parents and all that. And I didn't have any friends that were more than, that were 21, right? So, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. So, you know, so the security guard, you know, he was like, when I won the race, he was like, in, you know, I could see him. He wasn't that far from me, right? So I went up to him and I started to talk. And I'm saying, you know, because it was everybody knew it was a big triple. I mean, I had the, by the way, I had the whole pool. I had the whole fucking pool.
And would people around you know that? I mean, you said you had to look at the ticket, so it's not like you were jumping up and down.
No. I wasn't jumping around. Yeah. I was just like, I was in silent shock.
Yeah.
And nobody knew shit, right? But I later knew, you know, I knew I had the whole pool. Not that second, but I did have the whole pool. I had the whole I had the whole trifecta pool. And anyway, so I go up to the security guy and I start like beating around a bush and I said, you know, like, you know, because I'm looking at the tote board and I'm pointing to him. I said, somebody wins that. Like, you know, how do you cash the ticket? What do you have to do? And he said, yeah, it's a little bit of a hassle. You got to do this, you got to do that. And by the time I got like to the fourth question, he looked at me. I'll never forget the look on that he gave me for the rest of my life. He looked at me like a kidding, slanted look. Like he said to me, like, you didn't win that, did you?
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, he didn't say. He said, "You didn't. You don't have the winning ticket, do you?"
Right.
I looked at him. I said, "Well, I got three of them." and he looks at me, and I go, "Yeah, like, so you know, like, how do I cash this?" So he says to me, "I'll tell you what." He says, "You give me the three tickets, right? And I'll do it for 10%." You give me the three tickets, and I'll do it for 10%, and I'll get it done for you.
Right.
Nice. I'll meet you here tomorrow with the 24,000 minus the 2,400. I'll meet you tomorrow.
That sounds risky.
Right? And I'll give you the money. Right? Now, I at that second, I didn't process that the guy's probably making $5 an hour.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And what year is this? I mean, yeah. $24,000, I mean.
Yeah. Right. Is this like mid-60s, mid-70s? When are we talking here?
No. We're talking early 70s now.
Okay, because I just did a calculation, and in 1970, if we just do 1970, $24,000 in today's dollars is about $200,000. So that's a lot of money.
Right. So we're talking about the high rate, not only the high rate of the value of the currency. We're talking about the high rate of stupidity on my part there also, obviously. So now I give the guy the tickets, and the guy says to me, meet me here tomorrow night, 5 minutes before post time, 5 to 8, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, I'll be here, right? So now I'm walking out, you know, to my car, and I'm walking out, and it's like, it hits me, what did I just do? You know, I gave the guy $24,000. I know the guy three, you know, I met the guy three times.
Yeah, right. He has no incentive to pay me this money.
I mean, you know, there's just no way a guy's coming back with my money. All right, so when I drove home, you know, the emotions I went through that night, you know, from the win to realizing I had the tickets, and then to this complete depression. That ride home was the most depressing most depressing moments of my life.
I'll bet. Know? It's that moment of clarity, and you realize what you've done. You were so excited in that moment, though, and you got to find a way to get this money. And then here's this nice guy. He offers. You're also young, so you know it. You don't process that stuff as quickly.
Right. And I'm also a nut. You know, I'm still to this day. I'm still a nut. There's no doubt about it. Right. You have to be a nut to do what I did with my whole life. Anyway. So I go home now. right? And now, that whole night and the whole next day, I swear to you, I'm trying to decide whether I even want to go back there or not, to go back to the track, you know, for the ridiculous.
Sure.
And why wouldn't you want to? Just because you're afraid of the embarrassment? Or not because
just because, you know, I didn't want to. You know, I knew the guy wasn't going to be there, right. So I didn't want to deal with it again.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, I'd rather just, you know, take my
learn your lesson once and not do it again.
Yeah, but it's a really, really rough lesson. So,
right.
You know, so now it's the next day, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon now, and so now this happened at Roosevelt, so it's about an hour away from where I lived, right? So now I'm, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock at night, it's like a definite no, I'm not going. And then, you know, but the compulsiveness in me and the psychotic thought process led me to get in the car and go.
Well, yeah, you're a gambler. I mean, at least with this, you've got a chance. It's like that unscratched ticket.
Yeah.
You know, there's it's even if the odds are long, it's
something.
You definitely don't get the money if you stay home.
You could put me in front of Freud. I don't know if even Freud could actually come up with the actual reason why I went, really. And anyway, so I went. And now, so I actually got there early. It was, you know, now I was afraid I was going to miss the guy. You know, I'm such a freak. I was afraid I was going to get there too late. And he would just say, well, the guy didn't show up.
Right.
You know, I then had processed in my mind, in my sick mind, that the guy was going to be there and I was going to fuck it up by being late.
Okay.
I went from that, from the thought of he's never going to be there, to the depression, to then to another kind of depression and anxiety. Because I would be late and not get paid because I didn't show up, right? So I went through all of that shit. So, but I get there like 20 minutes early. You know, I'm walking around looking for him, and I don't see him, right? And now it's, you know, the marshal calls the pacers, you know, so it's 10 to 8. And now the horses are, you know, walking along, you know, slowly galloping along the track. And, you know, and I'm in the depression again. Now it's 5 to 8, and that's when he said to meet him there, right? And I'm looking around, there's nobody there, and the horses are now coming. You know, you know on the trotters how they start with the car, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now the car's now the marshal calls the pacers, and the horses are coming up to the car, and the race is they're coming right down down the top of the stretch to the starting gate, to the starting point. Where the car lets them go,
right.
And I'm sitting there, you know, like a snowman, basically, just frozen stiff with all these terrible feelings, right? And then at that moment, there's a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and the security guard is standing right behind me.
No fucking way.
Yeah, and he says, come with me. I follow him. He takes me, around the grandstand to a little nook and cranny. Hands me an envelope, a big envelope, you know, bulging with the cash. He says, "I took my 10%. It's all there." And then he turns to me. He starts to turn away from me. Says, "Nice knowing you."
Yeah, no kidding.
And he walked away.
Wow.
And he took just the 10%.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I didn't. Well, so what I did is I immediately stuffed the money in my pants, in my underpants, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was bulging, right?
Right.
I stuffed the money in my pants, and I start walking out. You know, first, my next thought is, all right, he set me up to get
exactly
robbed.
That's what I'm worried you're going
to
say.
Yeah, he set me up to get robbed. Because when he said, nice knowing, you know, nice talking, you know, whatever he said, right?
Right.
And so I'm walking out now, you know, and I'm looking behind me, I'm taking security turns. When I get outside, like in the parking lot, you know, I must have walked like 15 minutes, making circles and turns and this and that. And then finally, it became apparent that nobody was following me, right? So I get in the car, right? I drive straight home, right? I get into my house, I go into my room, and take the money out of my pants, and I count it, and it was all there, minus the count, it was all there. And so it was like the greatest thing that ever happened to me, and at the same time, maybe the worst thing that ever happened.
Exactly, sure, because right. Now you've definitely got the bug. You were probably going to have it.
Mentioned.
Yeah, but now it's got its claws in you for good. There's no getting around it. So
yeah, but you got $200,000 as like a 16-year-old kid.
That's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's just like you said. Now I buy a brand new Mustang convertible.
Yeah, there you go.
$7,000 at the time, which how much is $7,000 back then? I don't know. But whatever it
enough
was.
To buy a Mustang, so 40, 50 yeah, grand.
So I buy the car, right? Now, I had friends whose parents were, some of their fathers were gamblers and went out to Vegas a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So I had friends that, a lot of mob guys. You know, I grew up with a bunch of mob kids too. So I had, I had these friends and their fathers were going out to Vegas and stuff. So, I kind of knew what was going on in Vegas, and I knew a lot of people's names, from New York that went out to Vegas. And back then, like if you remember the movie Casino, the mob guy in Kansas City, remember that?
Mm-hmm. Robert De Niro, yeah. Great movie.
Back at the grocery store.
Yeah, yeah. So remember they were delivering the money to the mob guy in Kansas City. In the convenience store, remember?
Yeah,
in the back of it. Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, I knew a lot of people's names and stuff. And now at that time, we're talking 73, 74. The mob was just at that time. It was the tail end of the mob's involvement. They were still involved, by the mid 70s, the mob started to get chased out by the corporations. But at this time, there was still a mob element in the casinos, right? Mm-hmm. So I decided I had 20 grand, right? Plus, I had about 20 grand, right? And the car. And I drive out to Las Vegas by myself, right?
So I get how old are you at this point?
Almost 18.
Jesus, man.
Right. So
that's
I,
a story. You got the top down driving to Vegas with 20 grand in your pocket?
Yeah.
Well, it gets better. Right. So I drive to Vegas, and you're saying, you can imagine, not even 18 years old, 20 grand, beautiful convertible car, right? Mm. And I'm driving out to Vegas and with the top down, driving across the desert. It's like you think of the song by the Eagles, right? What's that song called? Hotel California.
Yeah,
I'm driving to Vegas, right? And I couldn't have been, I was on cloud 9999. I couldn't have been feeling any more juiced up. Right. I didn't care about nothing. I just couldn't wait to get out there and start gambling. Right.
All right. I have one question for you real quick. Do you tell your parents? Are you like, hey.
You obviously didn't buy him a house.
I got a dream. I'm following a dream, boys. And they're like, go ahead.
Well, by that time, I was more or less on my own already.
Okay.
Yeah, I was still living in their house, but I was more or less, they had given up on me. That mattered about a week later into the story. Mattered. But I drive out there, and I knew some names at the old Riviera Hotel, which just got imploded a couple years ago. So I go into the Riviera, and I mention some names, and they say, I speak to the casino manager, and they said, first question, how much cash you got with you? I said, 20 grand. I said, okay, put the 20 grand in the cage, okay, and you can sign markers against it, and we'll fix you up with a suite, and you got room, food, and beverage, anything you want, you just let me know, right, because I mentioned the right names. So I put the 20,000 in the cage, right, and they give me a room, and I go up to the room, right, and you ever see the movie Rain Man with Tom Cruise? Remember that suite?
Yeah.
Okay, now the suite they gave me in the Riviera wasn't quite that nice, but it was along those lines. It had a regulation pool table in it.
Okay.
Now, back in those days, even in the most expensive hotel rooms in all of the United States, they had the price of the room on the door, like cheap hotels do.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. Got it.
Yeah, like you don't see that anymore in hotels, but back then, you know, if you're staying in the penthouse in Caesar's Palace, it would have the how much that room is a night if you're paying for it, right? So on the room, on the price at the door, on the inside of the door at the Riviera, the room I was staying in was $800 a night.
Okay.
Back at that time.
About $5,700 today.
$800 a night, and they gave me anywhere I wanted to eat, and just sign for anything else. I wanted girls, anything. Right. This is how it was. Right.
Yeah.
So I go to the after I got over the unbelievable luxury of the room and everything. So I didn't even care that much. I was just wanted to get to gambling, right? So I read a lot about the game Baccarat.
Yeah.
And I learned the game. I even dealt hands out to myself, before I even left Vegas. So I knew the game. Because at that time, Baccarat, you've heard of Baccarat, right?
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Player.
Yeah, player banker,
yeah, and the banker's got a 51%.
I didn't know if that the generativeness of gambling led to the casino.
Oh boy, yeah, me and you got a lot in common.
All right, okay.
Well, except for the $800 a night suite, I never got that.
Yeah, you weren't that unlucky.
Yeah, right. I guess.
So anyway, I knew the game Baccarat, and at that time, very few. Caucasians played it.
Yeah, but it was mostly Asian people,
kind
right?
Kind of still that way, isn't it?
All Asian people.
Yeah, Asian people still play it. I don't know why that is, but Asian people, James Bond.
Yeah. They changed it in James Bond in the new movie. They changed it to poker, but he was in the books. He was playing Baccarat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the reason is it's not even an Asian game. It comes from France and Italy. But the reason for some reason the Asians identify their culture in it. It's like in their blood. I mean, first of all, they're the biggest degenerate gamblers in the world.
Right.
The Chinese. But then they've also, over the years, they've associated Baccarat with their culture. And that's why they love the game so much. So anyway, I go to the Baccarat table, and I'm watching. I'm standing behind there. And there were a few Arab sheiks playing in their white robes. And I don't know if you ever stood next to an Arab sheik in the white robes and those leather straps around the headdress.
Right.
But it's really impressive. It's really, really impressive. I mean, when you see them in those garments. So there were a couple of them, and the rest of the table, of course, was Asians. So I'm standing behind this, right? And, you know, this is like a huge moment for me. It's my first time in a casino, right? And it's a $100 minimum table, okay? And I'm looking at these people, and they're all in their 40s and 50s, right? And I'm not even 18, and for me to get the, I don't want to use the word balls, but to get into that chair was like huge.
Sure.
So I go up and I sign a marker against my $20,000 for $5,000. Right. Okay. So I signed a mark. They give me $5,000, right, in the chips. They give me the $5,000. And my very first bet, I mean, you're not, no one in the history of the world, probably, except for maybe somebody that belongs to a royal family. Nobody in the history of the world, their first bet in a casino was $500.
No. Right. Especially when we adjust and say, all right, $35,000 into today's money. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty rare for the first casino bet, $500. But that was my first bet.
A banker or player? Do you remember?
Player. Oh, yeah, of course.
Always player.
Yeah, player. Right. So I bet.
Why do you always do player? Because you just don't want to pay the commission? Fuck them?
No, I fuck them later on. For about
right. Well, that's always why I take the player, just because of my head. I'm like, fuck you and your commission.
No. I just play player. That I can't tell you.
Okay. I just thought that's why I do it, because I don't want to pay a commission on that.
Yeah. But actually, the banker is a better bet.
It is. It's like 51-49, but you got to pay commission on it, so fuck them.
No. But even with the commission.
I know. It's still, the odds are on the banker, right?
It's a principle of it for him.
like, let's put it to you this way. The house edge when you bet the bank is like 1.15.
Yeah.
And when you bet the player, it's maybe 1.21. It's not really, you know.
Pretty close.
Negligible.
Yeah.
But it is a little better. Anyway, so I make the bet. I win. And I'm playing. And I'm just winning. I'm just, you know. It was a hot table. Everybody was more or less playing, following the shoe. And I was winning. So I won $20,000.
Jesus.
Are you doubling your bet every time?
No, I'm not doubling the bet every time, but I'm betting basically 500.
500 every time, all right.
500 up to 1,000 every
okay.
time. And I was there 3-4 hours, I won $20,000.
Okay.
Wow.
So you don't know. Well, you probably do know, maybe on a smaller level, but the feeling of that, I was in such a high. So now I just won $20,000, right? Now yeah. I go into a restaurant, right? And by myself, you know, with the champagne, right? And I ordered baked Alaska for dessert, which I never heard of before that. I had to order it like 3 hours before you knew you were going to eat it.
Yeah.
Because I had to prepare it. I ordered so the bill by myself was like $350.
Right.
Right. And that, you know, of course, well, you know, Vegas restaurant bills are inflated,
right.
But you're talking $350, right? Back then,
$2,500
by myself, right?
Yeah.
And so all I'm doing is signing the, you know, signing the chits and all that, and then I go up to my room and I left out there was a sunken jacuzzi in the suite also.
Nice.
So now I'm up there laying in the, I don't know, you remember the movie The Gambler with James Caan?
Yeah. Of course.
Well, he was sitting in the bathtub listening to the basketball game.
Yeah, yeah.
I was sitting in this jacuzzi, you know, just like soaking in the suds of that huge win and that huge dinner that I just had. I mean, it was just.
Yeah, because you just like, added $20,000 to your winnings,
right.
And just another $143,000 in today's money. So you're sitting on enough wealth at 17. To buy a couple homes.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that you're not a little bit overstating that.
I'm just going with the government's inflation calculator. But still, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
Yeah. But well, okay, wait. So I win $20,000, right? And so the next day, it's not like I have any kind of control over this. But I was trying to think back then that maybe I did. But anyway, so I managed to wait like a whole 16 hours before I went back to the baccarat table.
Okay.
You know, between sleeping and not sleeping and just laying in the bathtub and all that. So I went down the next day and I won another 15 or 18,000. And then I won again and again and again and again and again. So to make the long story short, within a week, I was up $100,000 in cash, and I had a shoebox in the room. I had a shoebox full with $100,000, okay, in cash, and I was living like this. And I believed it was going to go on forever. I believed that, you know, within a month I was going to, you know, check out of there with a couple of million dollars, and that was the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking anything beyond that. I just couldn't lose. You know, I was blessed, just like James Caan says in The Gambler. You know,
yep.
I was blessed, right? And it was going to go on forever. And then came my 18th birthday. Then came my 18th birthday. On that day, so it's just a week later, on that day, I lost not only the $100,000 profit, but my $20,000.
God.
I lost everything in one day, okay? Everything. So now I got the car. Okay, I got the car. I paid $7,000 for the car. I drove it right to a used car lot, right? The car only had like, you know, 3,000 miles on the odometer, but more or less the distance from New York to Las Vegas mm-hmm. driving, right? I sold the car at a used car lot for $1,500.
Ouch.
Right? I take the $1,500. I go back into the Riviera. I'm still staying there, right? I go back to the Riviera, right? I put the $1,500 on player, right? The player gets a natural nine, and so does the bank, tie hand. I leave the bet there.
Fucking
same
gosh.
Hand. Player, natural nine.
Bank wins. Tie hand. Ugh. Natural nine. Two natural nine ties in a row. Third hand. Bank gets a natural eight. Player gets a natural eight. Bank wins. Natural nine.
Motherfucker, man. Motherfucker. Yeah, so, I don't like in my stomach, I don't like it right now, hearing it. Fuck them.
I was already in a daze. I was just standing there like, I don't know where my brain was.
But it's also the arc of every gambler's origin story. Not most people win that much money early on. But you start winning, you think, I've got this figured out. And you, like you say, you start thinking, I'm just going to keep winning. Whether it's because of luck or because I've figured out the system, whatever it is, I just know how to do this. I've got this. I can't lose. And I'm also going to stop after I just win a little bit more money. And then, of course, everybody likes to think they've got control. As a gambler, you have to pretend like you've got control that you don't. That's why there's so many superstitions in the casino. And you go, okay, I've got control. I can't lose. Just win a little bit more. And then you lose it all. I mean, that is a fairly common story. The difference is most people didn't have nearly as much to lose at such a young age. Right.
Yeah, and don't forget, my experience is two-tiered. It started with that unbelievable win at the track.
Exactly.
So because of what happened at the track and then what was happening there in the baccarat table, I was exponentially devoured by what you just said.
Yeah, and that's when you start to go, wait, I did something wrong. This wasn't supposed to happen. Right. I got to figure this out.
Yeah. So now I got nothing, right? I'm wiped out. I was broke. And when I say broke, when a lot of people say they're broke, they got $20 in their pocket, they got loose change in their pocket. I'm talking broke, nothing, not one penny, not one U.S. penny, broke. And I'm now still staying in an $800 a night suite.
You got that going for you.
So I got a place to sleep, and I'm still... they don't know I'm broke yet, right? And I'm still signing for the dinners and that. But meanwhile, so this went on for 3 or 4 days, right? And I'm trying to figure out my next move. Now I am broke. Now, so when I talked about my parents coming back into this a week after the story, so I thought about calling my parents and telling them, I'm stuck out here in Vegas. Can you send me $400 so I can get home, right? Mm-hmm. Fly home. Right. And they said no. And then I called friends. I called friends and don't forget when I was at the days I was going to the track and I had all the money, I was always giving my friends money and people like that. And I call up people, say, hey, can you do me a favor? Send me $400. This is Richie. Can you send me who? Richie who?
Of course.
Right? Yeah, of course.
You know how it goes, right?
Balls didn't come through?
No, Balls didn't come through either.
Man, fuck him too then.
He didn't come through either. But he actually didn't have it because he was such a...
I was going to say, some people just don't have it.
He was broke all the time because he was such a freak. He would have given it, but he couldn't come through and he couldn't get it. Anyway... So now what happens is, I'm still eating great and this and that, but I got to make a move now. I don't know what to do, right? So then one day I'm going up to the room, the fourth day, and back then, like I said, they had the $800 sign on the, on the door of the room. Also back then, which you guys are probably too young to remember, is when you went into hotels, right? They didn't have, it wasn't all the digital locks and the key and the key cards, right? You had keys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like you get into your house, you had keys to get into your hotel room. So I went up there one night and I put my key in the door and I see that it won't go in all the way. The key will not go in the lock all the way. And I take a look and I see a little pin sticking in the lock. And that's, they call that getting pinned out of your room. So I knew what it was. I was expecting it. So I go down to the front desk and I said, "There's a problem. I can't get into my room." And they said, "Yeah, I'm sorry. So you're gonna have to go see security." So I went to see security, and they told me, "I'm sorry, sir. You're being asked to leave the hotel, and we'll walk you up to your room. You can get your stuff, and then you have to leave." Right.
Okay.
So they walk me up to the room, right? And I didn't have that much with me. I had very little stuff with me, right? I basically had a white shirt and blue cutoff jeans, which I was wearing. And it's a it This is in the middle of the summer now. It's 115 degrees outside, right? So I had the white shirt and a pair of blue jeans, and I had a couple of pair of pants or shirts in a suitcase, a wheelie, right? A little wheelie suitcase. So it's and I said, okay, you got your stuff? Yeah, okay, all right. We'll walk you to the front door, and you can't come back. Imagine that, you can't come back.
Right.
So I walk outside, and the heat. I mean, so you imagine when a couple of days ago, I was sitting in the jacuzzi in the room, you know, eating $300 dinners, right? And I had a shoebox of more than 100K cash, right, hidden in the room, right? And now I'm leaving the hotel with a suitcase, right? And when that heat hit my face, you know, 115 degrees. I mean,
so
you
did
imagine,
reality.
Yeah. You can imagine that slap, that heart slap in the face. I mean, it's just really bad, right? So the first thing I do when I get outside is I see a garbage can to the side of the door. So I just wheel the suitcase over to the garbage can, and I just leave it there. I mean, what am I going to do? I'm not going to walk around Vegas in 115 degree heat with a suitcase. I don't even have enough money. I don't have any money. I can't take a bus. I'm walking. Wherever I'm going, I'm walking. Right. So I went from the convertible car and all this shit. And a week later, I'm walking broke and desperate and no chance of getting any money from anybody to get home. That's where I was at. So where am I going to sleep? So where am I going to sleep that night? Right. So, and now I'm tired. Right. So I get to an overpass. Any of you guys ever been to Vegas?
Yeah,
of course.
Okay. Well, it's obviously completely different than it was then. But back then, you know, like Las Vegas Boulevard, it was just a street. You could run across the street to get from one side to the other, like any other street in Kansas City. You know, now it takes, if you want to cross the street, it takes 20 minutes to get there, no matter how you go. You walk, take a taxi or whatever, it takes 20 minutes to get the other side of the street. You know, you got to go up and down, over and out the stairs. Anyway, back then, though, it was different. So there was the overpass that is, well, it's still there, obviously, but the overpass that was at the corner of Tropicana and the Strip.
Yep.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
There was a bunch of bums and winos more or less hanging out there. So, it was like, hot, humid, not humid, just hot, but 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm tired. So I said, might as well sleep here. So I laid down on the ground, right, with my white t-shirt and my black cutoff jeans, right? A bunch of disgusting people, right? And pissing all over the place. It's disgusting, right? And this is where I went, right? The night before I was sleeping in an $800 a night suite, and now I'm laying there on the street, right? And it just so happened that a fight broke out that very first night I was there. A fight broke out. People were throwing bottles around, and a bottle landed right near me and splattered, and a piece of the glass came up and caught me like right on the side of the mouth. And I still have a little scar from that to remind me of that.
Okay.
Right. I still have a little scar. And so I ended up staying there, living there for 3 weeks.
Wow.
Okay. 3 weeks I slept under the bridge right now in order to clean myself. Right. I would go to the back to the Riviera Hotel. Right. And in those days, you could actually walk into the pool area right from the street. You know, it wasn't like it's not. So I would sneak into the pool area, and I would wash up, right? And they had razor blades to shave in there, right? So I took a razor. I was able to shave with soap, right? And I lived like that for 3 weeks. And to eat, I would just go into coffee shops. And I would just order and eat, and then I would ask, for like dessert or something, or another Coke or something. And then when the waitress went back, and I to get what I wanted, I would just leave and not pay. Right. I hated doing that, especially because I was stiffing the waitresses.
Right.
I hated doing that, but it was survival.
Yeah.
So I managed to eat. I managed to eat three meals a day by just going to different coffee shops every night and doing the same thing. I managed to eat. But after 3 weeks of this, finally, it was starting to wear me out. You know, I was starting to get physically sick, you know, losing weight. And, you know, I was literally starting to die. You know, if I didn't find a way out of this, I was going to eventually die. And I was starting to really feel weak and sick.
Right.
So finally, I had to do something. So the only thing that I could think of doing was I had to get a job. And the only thing I knew in life, even now, forget about Ben, even now, is gambling in casinos, right? So I figured, well, I guess I can get a job as a dealer, right? So I asked somebody, how do you get a job as a dealer in this town? They said, well, what you have to do is you have to go downtown. You know, that's where the local shittier casinos are. So, well, back then, downtown was a lot shittier than it is now.
Right.
So you have to go downtown, and you walk in there, and you ask for an audition, right? And they put you on a game, and if you can deal, you can deal on that. And so I said, yeah, it was easy. But then they said, you have to go to a dealer school first and learn how to deal. You know, take a course and learn how to deal.
Right.
So the dealer school was $350. So I didn't have 350 pennies, let alone $350. So I just went to a dealer school, and I kind of like hung out, you know, on the fringes of it, near the door. I didn't register or I didn't pay, and I just kind of watched, right? And then, you know, the instructors, they saw me a couple of days, and they just figured that I was one of the students.
Sure.
And then I started to actually, I became one of the students. And after like a week, when I was practicing dealing, one of the instructors came up to me, and he needed help because there were a lot of people in there. He said, yeah, could you just help some of the other dealers on this table? So that told me that I was now dealing well enough
right.
to try and go get a job, right? So I was I go downtown, I go to the Four Queens downtown, and I go in and I see the ship boss, right? And I'm wearing my white shirt and my blue cutoffs because that's still the only clothes that I have. And I would wash my underwear and my T-shirt in the bathroom of the Riviera, right? So anyway, I walk in there, and I ask for the casino manager, and I find the casino manager, and I say, yeah, I'd like to audition for a job. And he looks at me, and he laughs, and he goes, kid, you can't come in here like that. You got to have a white dress shirt and a pair of dark pants, preferably black, and then you come back and see me, right? So remember I told you about the suitcase I wheeled outside of here? Guess what was inside there?
Exactly what you needed.
Exactly what I needed, right? So now I got to get a white shirt and black pants. Now, besides my kiddie scams, I never stole. I don't even know if you call that stealing, but I never stole anything from anybody. I never, I never stole anything. I never ripped off anybody except for the kiddie scams, right? Mm. So the one time in my life I ever stole anything out of a store was I went to Sears. I went to Sears with my white shirt and my blue cutoff jeans. I walked in there, found a white shirt and a pair of black pants. Went into the dressing room, tried it on, right? Cut off the tags and walked out.
Right.
So that was it. I got my shirt, my pants. I went back to the casino, the Four Queens. I auditioned. I got the job. And the reason they hired me right away is because they were just starting to put in mini baccarat tables downtown, which
perfect.
Is perfect blackjack size tables.
Yeah,
right.
That have baccarat, right? So, and there were not many people that not many dealers knew how to deal it, but I knew how to deal it because I played it so much, right? So I went in there, I got the job, and I'm getting to the end of my story now, which is good for knowing other things. So I got the job, and I just was looking to put $400 together so I can get the hell out of there. But and I got myself I rented a flea bag hotel room for like $20 a week.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I lived there and I was just trying to get $400 together so I can get home. right? And I couldn't do it. I was making like $15 a night in tips. Like, I just was making enough money to survive. Eat and survive, and because nothing else. So I didn't want to run out of coffee shops anymore. So I just couldn't do it. So 1 month went to 2 months, 4 months, 6 months. So and now so I was dealing, and you know, while I was dealing in the Four Queens, you know, in these downtown casinos, you know, a lot of weirdos come up to you. They come up to you with all kinds of weird propositions. You know, like, you know, one guy came up to me one night. He said, "Yeah, if you signal me the value of your hall card." In those days, the dealers had to look at their hall cards.
Yeah.
They didn't have the little gizmos right there where you could see what the hall card was, right? So, and they would say, card readers, they're called. They didn't have the card readers.
Mm-hmm.
So then they would say, "Well, you tell us what your hall card is, and we'll split the profit."
So that starts almost immediately once you get the job dealing, or these guys coming up to you saying, "Hey, we're looking for someone on the inside. Here's an offer."
Yeah,
and you're turning them down at first?
Almost immediately, yeah. Mm-hmm. You would get that. I remember one really hot-looking woman with big tits came in, and she said, "Yeah, you help me on your table, and I'll help you in my bed."
Right. So you did that one, right?
I hope you said yes to that one.
Of course.
Okay. Good.
That's where it started. There you go.
So, one night, a guy comes in a guy comes into my table and he leans over and he kind of whispers to me. He goes, "I got a guy that's got a stolen 747 aircraft in the desert. And you know anyone who wants to buy it?"
Asking a kid.
That's great.
Yeah, sure. I'll call some of my friends.
But meanwhile, I was just looking to, you know, keep my nose clean and just get out of there. But I couldn't do it. So one day a guy walks in, a guy by the name of Joe Klassen, Klasson, Joe Klassen, who walks in, and a sharp-looking guy, spoke really, really well. I mean, he was from New York, but he didn't speak like a typical New Yorker like I do. He spoke really well. I could see he was very intelligent, and we just started talking, and he didn't like sit at my table or anything. I was just standing behind the dead game, and we just started talking, "Where you're from?" And it turned out, and he's 20 years older than me. So, you know, back then, you know, I was not even 20, and he was 40. And so we're talking, and it says, "Why don't you come and meet me after your shift?" Right. And, I said, "Well, you know, no one ever asked me that before. You know, people made propositions to me, but nobody ever asked me to come and meet them at their shift, right? You know, after my shift or anything like that." So I said, "Yeah, okay, sure, why not?" Because I just felt, you know, I'm pretty good at sizing up people. I just felt there was something that this guy didn't want to talk about, something ridiculous.
Okay.
You know, I just felt that. So I met him there, and it was at the Horseshoe across the street. And I meet him there, and the first thing he says to me is, "How come you're the only dealer in that casino not stealing chips from the house?" And, you know, when he said that to me, I was, like, taken aback. I said, "Wow." And because I knew that the dealers were stealing, because I knew nobody, the supervisors and the pit bosses, had no clue what was going on or didn't give a shit because it was a little shithole.
Yeah, because you're downtown at the Four Queens.
Yeah, right, because it was a little shithole casino, right? But, you know, like I said, I wasn't looking to steal. You know, they were stealing $5 chips out of the rack. I wasn't looking for any problem. I just wanted to get the fuck out of there, right? So I just wanted to get the hell out of there.
No,
so
you
I said, "Yeah, I'm just not." I told them the truth. I said, "I'm not interested. I'm just looking to, you know, keep my nose clean." And, you know, "Why are you asking me that?" I said, "You know, why is he asking me that?" So he said to me, "Well, I'm a professional casino chief, and I have a team, and I'm looking to recruit somebody for my team." And I was like, "What? You're a who? Or what?" You know, I never thought about, you know, I did my little kiddie scams, and
sure,
but I never thought about cheating casinos. You know, even though I didn't even know it was possible, really. I knew kids were stealing, but I didn't know about cheating, right? So he looks at me. I look at him. I go, "Why are you interested in me?" He said, "Well, I've been watching you for a couple of days, and I could see, you know, you look good and you handle the cards well, which both of those, back then I did look good and I did handle the cards well. And he said, so I said, yeah, okay, great. So I said, well, what do you want me to do? And what his response to that changed my whole life. Is what made my whole life, or from that point on.
Okay.
When I asked him, what do you want me to do, right, he just looked at me and shook his head, and he said, I don't want you to do anything. I want you to tell me what you're going to do.
Perfect.
And that was like the profundity of that word, of the way he put that. It's like, you know, he was challenging me, you know, going on his instinct that I was smart enough come up with something that he would be interested in doing.
Sure.
In the casino.
Some sort of information from the inside. And when people think about professional or organized casino cheats, they probably think about like 21 or, you know, whether they're counting cards or they're looking at the dealer cards with the team, like you're saying. It's MIT guys. You know, those famous stories about the MIT guys getting together. I'm never even close to getting into MIT. But your story about this idea that you end up, you're down on your luck, you're working as a dealer at a casino in Vegas, and this guy comes along. Everyone's been down on their luck. Most people have been down on their luck. Maybe not that much, but they've been down on their luck at some point. And they can imagine putting themselves in your position. And here comes this guy who says, all right, you're barely making enough money to pay your rent or whatever you want to call it at your shitty hotel. Do you want to help me cheat? And can you prove to me that you're worth my time by giving me an idea, that giving me something that would be worth my time? And that's it. Yeah. In that moment, you don't even really have a choice.
Yeah, but still, you're correct about that. But when he laid that number on me and said, no, I don't want you to do anything. The way he said, I don't want you to do anything.
Yeah.
You tell me what we're going to do. But not only that, he's building up my ego and telling me he's got confidence in
exactly.
me
right.
to tell him what to do. But he must have been, you know, he was watching me for a couple of days, and you know, he could tell that he's a smart guy, and I'm a smart
right.
guy.
He's grooming you essentially. I mean,
right.
that's what he's doing.
What I found fascinating with watching your videos is when we talk about those MIT guys and accounting cards and all those things. Like, there's so much math and, you know,
right.
signaling to the other person and all these fucking, like, here, when I watch your videos, it was really like, oh, when he turns his head, I steal a fucking chip. I'm like,
right.
it's like obvious fucking thing.
You're
like,
it's almost like being a magician.
The MIT guy, you know, that's baby shit. compare. And by the way, their stories are grossly exaggerated anyway.
Okay.
All that card counting stuff, that's baby, you know. Yeah, they sit there for hours and hours and hours and work on 1%. And I, you know, and my attitude is just like you just said, you know, I'm going in there and I'm getting the fucking money.
Flip the
right
table
now.
And grab the chips.
I'm not working on 1%. I'm working on 100%.
Yeah. And right? your baseball, you know, your baseball card trading days come in handy because,
yeah.
what you know, with this roulette scam where you're literally just replacing you're putting a $5,000 chip with the $5 chips, so that when the dealer sees this, he thinks it's a stack of $5 chips, and you can now use that to your advantage. And it's so simple, yet so brilliant. It's one of those things where, like you said earlier, I didn't even know people could cheat the casinos. I didn't know people could cheat the casinos like the way you did.
There's so much to talk about. Like, you're talking about that Savannah that I did, which it's the greatest move of all time because of how Kiss it was. Keep it simple, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
The move was just what it was. You know, I would bet $5,000 chips on roulette wheels and just crack a $5 chip off the top of it so that the dealers couldn't see that the $5,000 was underneath. They only assumed it was another $5 chip, right? And that was the whole move. I won, I got paid, I lost. If they caught me taking it off, I raked it off. Most of the time, they didn't even catch it. But when they caught me, I just had two $5 chips palmed in my pocket. I put it back. They would scream, hey,
so they go, hey, what are you doing? Yeah, you just throw the $5 chip down. Sorry.
Yeah, and I just put back what they thought was there, so they would never cross surveillance. But anyway, toward the end of that move, you know, we were just blasted in Vegas with that, me and this one other guy, Pat, and Balls was involved in that too. And, you know, we were making anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000 a weekend on that for 8 months straight, and they knew it was me. They knew at that time I was already known as the biggest international casino cheat in the world. They knew it was me, and they had no idea what I was doing, because every time they only went to surveillance and checked the video when the bet won.
Right.
And when the bet won, the video backed up. It was a legitimate bet.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Now I knew I was being followed all over Vegas, but whenever I needed to lose, you know, unless they're following you by air, they can't follow you if you know what you're doing. So anyway, I knew I was being followed all over town while this was going on. But what I didn't know, and I found out later when I started working for casinos, and I was actually working with people that spent 20 years chasing me, right? What I didn't know is that they were going into these casinos. The Nevada Gaming Control Board was going into these casinos with their tech teams and their laboratory teams, taking apart roulette wheels all over Las Vegas, looking for remote control or digital type devices that they thought maybe I was putting under the wheels that I could control where the ball dropped.
Yeah,
now that shit didn't even exist then.
Right.
You know, we're talking in the 90s now. There was no digital technology being used in cheating, but they had no clue. It was just a simple, ridiculous move. I just put the money there. If I won, like you said, I just take the fucking money. If I lose, I get paid. If I lose, I just take my bet back.
Yeah,
right. They had no clue. They must have spent $1 million investigating me and following me and all this shit. And little did they know, it was the most ridiculous.
Just grabbing the chip. Because in the 80s, they did have the video poker issue in the 80s where, you know, a company that was supplying the machines was working on the inside and saying, hey, okay, you know, we want to get our machines in your bar, so we don't want you to buy from the competitors, so we'll give you an advantage. You don't have to pay out as many winners. And once, you know,
a guy got murdered.
Murdered in his driveway. And I'm sure that they're thinking at that point, you know, they wanted to put that behind them. They want people to think that gambling is, you know, as fair as it's supposed to be, which however fair that is, but as fair as it's supposed to be. So when they start seeing this, I'm not surprised that they're thinking it's got to be something digital. It's got to be manipulating the wheel somehow, predicting something. There's got to be something that we can't see, because it's just so simple that they didn't even think to look.
Exactly. One guy said to me that, you know, I've done a lot of TV shows with this, and I did a TV show with a guy that was the head detective for a place called Griffin Investigations.
Right.
And they worked for all the casinos, and they were investigating me. And he became a friend of mine after I started to work for the casinos. And he was telling me all these stories about what Vegas was going through, trying to find out what I was doing and stop me. And Steve Wynn himself, the reason why Steve Wynn put he was the first guy when he opened up the Mirage to put in the 24/7 total coverage of all their gaming tables.
The reason
he did it mainly is because of me, because I was victimizing me, Pat and Balls. We were victimizing, you know, the Mirage and all the other MGM resorts at the time, and we were victimizing them. And finally, they had enough of it. And anyway, but the point is that. That, you know, they were so, this scam, this Savannah scam, not only was it the greatest scam ever, it will never be equaled. It's impossible for anybody, I mean, it's to use the word impossible with as much accuracy as possible, it's impossible to come up with a scam that good, because it had no risk to it.
Well, let me ask you something. Can those scams, these great scams, it seems like once these scams are executed and they're successful, you can really never do them again, it feels like, because the casinos now, that's on their list of things to look for. Or could you still pull off the Savannah scam today?
Yes, exactly. So many things here. Okay, first of all the great scams you heard about, besides mine, you only heard about them because they got caught.
Right.
My scam never got caught. The only I let everybody know about it when I wrote my book about it, about my career.
Okay? And that's American Roulette.
That's when people were freaking out. Wow, I can't believe this was a scam. You know, people in the business, and that's how I got invited to speak at all these gaming conferences, and that's how I ended up, you know, getting into game protection and all that. But another thing, to your point about, this is the one scam people can still do, right? And as a matter of fact, you know, I don't know if you know what I do now. I train casinos all over the world. And I also have held major conferences, one of which is on Monday in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I have 50 people, 25 to 50 people, depending on which conference it is, the experts from across the world to speak about everything related to table games and cheating and surveillance. And anyway, so to address your point is that, so when I train these casinos, I always, of course, show that Savannah move, and I show them how to stop it. And the only way to stop it, it's very easy. All the dealer has to do is, after the dealer says no more bets on roulette and waves it off, the betting, the dealer just needs to come out of his box and just look at the chips on the bottom of the ladder.
Yeah.
Just take a look and make sure there's no big denomination chips under there, right?
And that solves that.
So several times over the last 10 years, I've gotten a call from a surveillance director who I just trained, him and his whole staff. Hey, guess what, Richard? Somebody was here last night doing your Savannah move.
Oh, really?
And that's exactly what I would say. Yeah. Oh, really? I go, oh, really? And he goes, yeah. He goes, yeah. And I go, yeah, so you didn't pay him, right? Oh, no, we paid him. I go, what? What? Wasn't I just there 2 weeks ago showing you guys,
right,
you know, how to stop this? Yeah, you were here, but you know what happens, you know, it never gets, you know, the training you do, it was great, but it never gets filtered down to the dealers, you know, and all this stuff. So you know, people are out there still doing it.
Well, Savannah move still works if you want.
Yeah, because once you get the bet down, right, and the dealer doesn't see, because if the dealer happens to see the bet, our plan was always to just say, oh, I didn't mean to bet that, and take it back before they spun the ball. But in 1,000 times, the dealer never saw the bet one time.
Yeah.
Not one time. So if the dealer happens to see the bet, right, then fine. The person just, you know, could either has a choice, let it go legitimately or just take the bet back and say, oh, I didn't mean to bet that. I want to change something.
Right.
Okay, but the thing was is that, you know, nobody ever saw the bet, right? That it's just incredible. And I would actually do.
How much money do you think you made total scamming the casinos?
Okay, if you want to take all the money I made total as a team over the 25 years, the money we actually beat casinos out of would be about $25 million, right? That would be the figure of the money. It came out of the casinos. How much did I make personally after all the expenses? You have to understand that, you know, you're going around flying around the world in peak season,
sure,
and you're not making reservations for your airline tickets 2 weeks in advance. You got to be prepared to go from one place to the other the next day if you take heat, right? If you're in the Bahamas in the middle of January and you take heat and you got to leave and you're going to Aruba the next day, you know, you just go to the airport and you buy tickets. You know, it's $1,000 a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So all the expenses. So I figure that my total earnings were about $4 million, which, you know, it's a lot of money, but it's not, you know, that's how much LeBron James makes in 2 weeks.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but it's a lot of money. It's still a lot of money.
But how much now? Because you told us a story earlier about getting the $40,000, then the $100,000, and losing it. Now all these years later, $4 million, you still got it? Or did you fucking lose that too?
Okay, well, I still fucking got about half of it.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. More than what I thought you were going to say.
Wait a minute. I did not. When I started to cheat the casinos, after we did that baccarat. I forgot the best part of that story. Remind me to talk again about the money I spent.
Okay.
Right, just remind me. Okay. So let's go back to the Joe Klassen thing, right? So he said, what are you going to do, right? Do you tell me what you're going to do? So what I did is I came up with a scam, a baccarat scam, that I would do as the dealer, and I would fake shuffle the cards, right? And set up the cards, because in those days, they left the cards in the shoe.
Mm-hmm.
On dead games.
Sure.
Okay. So what I did was I faked. It's called a false shuffle baccarat scam. So I shuffled. I would fake shuffle the cards and protect about 8 or 10 hands coming off the top of the new shoe. And then they would come in and play. And the scam was so ingenious that I wouldn't even be the dealer. That the, when the money came off the table, I wasn't even the dealer. I had set up the shoe at the end of my shift. So the dealer relieving me would come in and not even know that the first 10 hands or so were fixed up.
Okay.
So it worked, and there's a tremendously funny story behind that scam, but I can't, when actually happened, I can't get into it. It's taking too much time. But anyway, it's in my book.
Okay.
You should get a hold of my book and read it.
Yes, American Roulette.
And all the backstories behind these incredible scams. It's just stuff that Hollywood producers could never make up. That's how good it is. So anyway, so we took the money. We took like $40,000 out of the Four Queens, in a shithole casino downtown in the 70s. I mean, that's a fortune. And, right. And they never knew what hit them. And I got a call 30 years later. In 2003 it was or something. I got a call in 2007, right? 30 some odd years later from the Toronto Star newspaper, a journalist. Actually, it was an email asking if they could call me, right?
Sure.
So I said, sure. So the journalist from the Toronto Star calls me the next day. And says to me, hi, Richard, thank you very much for taking my call. I just want to ask you something. Have you ever heard of the false shuffle baccarat scam?
Mm.
Okay. And her name was Robin, I remember. And I said, well, Robin, to tell you the truth, not really much, except that I invented it. Okay. Now, I wrote about that scam in my book, American Roulette, and I laid out exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I did, unbeknownst to me when Robin called me, is that two days before that, the FBI made the biggest casino cheating, organized racketeering, casino cheating bust in the history of gaming, which is still to this day. You guys have probably heard of it. It was done by a Vietnamese organization called the Tran Organization.
Oh, okay. I saw something on TV about it.
Yeah, and from 2003 to 2007, they were recruiting dealers, more or less the way Joe recruited me, but yeah. they weren't as smart. They were recruiting dealers all over the Western United States into Canada to do exactly what I did. To set up the cards,
right.
and they got caught because they got too greedy, but what they did was they had recruited like 40 or 50 dealers and some supervisors, including at the time the mayor of Seattle, Washington's son, who got arrested in that scam, and they got caught, and they took about $30 million out of the casinos over that period of time, 4 years. But they got caught because they got too greedy, and finally one of the dealers they recruited was an FBI agent with a wire.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So anyway, but they most likely, because my book came out in 2003, their scam started at the end of 2003.
Okay.
They most likely read about the scam in my book. And that's how they got the idea to do it. Most likely, I can't prove that. I'm not sure. But it's very coincidental. And then, so when she called me and she said, "Do you know anything about the false shuffle baccarat scam?" Well, I said, "Not really, not that much. I invented it. But did I really invent it? Who knows? I mean, somebody might have figured it out. It wasn't that hard to figure it out. But I'm certainly the first one known to have done it.
All right.
So anyway, so now let's get back to the 2000. Okay. How did I blow the money? All right. When I first, after I did that false shuffle baccarat scam, right? Then I joined their team, and now we never cheated a casino with inside help ever. It was just they taught me chip manipulation. My cheating was all chip manipulation. Every move that I did, up to the Savannah move, came through chip manipulation, which just means changing the chips.
Yeah.
Right. You know, some people mark the cards. You know, we change the chips. And when we started doing this right away, and first of all, what they showed me, I never believed that it could work because I was a dealer. And I looked at everything they showed me about, you know, how you change the chips and claim the dealer made mistakes and all this and all that. And I said, and I would say, you know, this is, I was a dealer for a year. That's how long I ended up dealing for, a year. This would never work.
Right.
And I had so much confidence in this guy, Joe, you know, and finally he said, look, kid, you want in or you want out? Because I don't need you doubting you, you know. You showed me that move you did before Queens, that little false shuffle move. We loved it. Now I'm the boss. Now either you want to do my moves or you're out.
Okay.
And I had no faith at all that any of his moves would ever work because they all went. And that's why this stuff is so good, because what I didn't know about was the psychology of it, how psychology is used, which is much more important than the move itself. Is you take psychological control of everybody in the casino, the dealers, the floor people, everybody. And that's what made me so successful. But I didn't know that at the time.
That's like being a magician. You play on people's expectations, and we like to think that we're harder to trick than that, but it's so simple. We may be looking for the bigger con, but that's so simple. Okay. It just works.
Right and wrong. You're right about what you're saying generally, but the word magician, you could throw that out. All casino cheating that's effective, it has nothing to do with sleight of hand, and magic's all about sleight of hand. And casino cheating has nothing absolutely to do whatsoever to do with magic. I never heard of a magician or anybody using sleight of hand that made $1 in a casino. It's all about timing. Mm-hmm. Sleight of hand is when you draw the attention of somebody away from what you don't want them to see. That's sleight of hand. Whereas when you do it right under the nose, with timing, this is what we did. So anyway, so when we were doing all this, when I first started, I was immediately, you know, making $5,000 or $10,000 a week right off the bat. And I would take that $5,000 or $10,000 and just go right after we cheated. And I would just go right in there and play legitimate baccarat and lose it, because I was such a junkie that I loved the action. I would just lose it. You know, if I won $15,000, I would lose that in a couple hours and then go back out and cheat it back and then go right back 6 hours later and lose it again. And this went on for 6 months. And then I finally realized, hey, this is real. Risk. And don't forget, everything in a lot of jurisdictions, not Kansas City, but in Nevada, any kind of cheating move at all is a felony. You could go to prison for 1 year on a first offense just for cheating for $5.
Okay.
In Nevada, right? So I was risking my, if they ever got me, it would have been, they would have put me in prison for 20 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I'm going in these casinos and I'm giving all the money back legitimately and I'm risking my ass for nothing. So finally, after like 6 months, I realized, hey, you know, it's like a coke deal or getting high in his own supply. So I'm saying, you know, this is ridiculous. So I finally stopped. And to this day, all my gambling is limited to, I'll never make a legitimate bet in a casino. If I lost $5 in a casino, I would have to go back and cheat $100,000 back. To this day,
right.
I don't need the money, but if I lost $5 in a casino, I'd be so pissed at myself. I'd have to cheat them for another $100,000 just to get even.
Yeah.
I'm serious. That's how I look at it. But yeah. Now, in order to avoid that scenario, I just bet on sports. Like one of you guys mentioned about sports betting. I just bet on sports, but I do it. I bet $300, $400, $500 a game, sometimes $1,000 a game. Nothing that's going to get me hurt.
But still scratches the itch.
Right. Yeah, no. And I happen to like what I'm doing now. I happen to like doing these conferences and doing the teaching. So I didn't blow my money. I spent it a lot, but I didn't blow it. Like I did in the beginning.
And you said, personally, you think it's, what did you say, $2 million, $4 million that you personally netted off the scams?
Personally, I put $4 million in my pocket from cheating casino. That's a very accurate guess.
Not too shabby. Well, Richard, Richard Marcus, the book is American Roulette, How I Turned the Odds Upside Down. I think everyone who's been listening to this, I would hope, has already either ordered the book or bought the Kindle version, because this is one of those few, probably the only, casino scam story where you go, hey, the guy who came up with these scams and ran these scams is saying you could probably still get away with some of these scams. So, you know, my interest has peaked. I haven't made $4 million yet. So, you know, the old Savannah move, I don't want to risk the time in prison, but I could absolutely ask our producer over here to take all the risk for me. We just got to save up enough to get that first $5,000 chip and then we'll be in the money. Richard Marcus, is there anywhere else people should find you, other things they should look for?
Well, I have a website called the GlobalTableGamesProtection.com.
Okay.
Global
Table Games Protection. To all of our casino owner listeners out there.
And I have, if anybody could Google me on YouTube, there's a lot of videos and stuff like that you can watch.
But there's a lot of good stuff.
None of them are going to be as good as the interview that you and I just did.
Hey, I appreciate that. Best interview we've ever done. Richard Marcus, American Roulette's the name of the book. People should get it. Thank you so much for your time, man. It was really fun talking to you.
All right, man. You guys take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that is it. Thank you so much for listening. Toxic and Problematic is brought to you by Mitra 9 Kratom and Kava. Visit Mitra-9.com and use promo code PROBLEMATIC for 25% off your order. Thank you to Direct Computer Outlet in Mission, Kansas for making our Twitch stream possible. Music graciously provided by Kid Computer. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Hi, everybody. It's Ryan Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.